Okay, so some of you will remember that we're going to spend a year, this has started 2 weeks ago, we're going to spend a year looking at the three jewels or the three refuges of Buddhism. The Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, or even the truth itself, which is the Dharma, and the Buddhist community, which is the Sangha. And we're going to start with the Buddha because that's where Buddhism starts. That's where Buddhism starts for us. So Buddhism starts with a human being, a man, who grows up he's born in Nepal, grows up in northern India, and 2,500 years ago, and he asks questions about life. He asks questions about existence, and he searches for answers, and then finally the truth dawns. And he sees the way things are. Wisdom arises, love floods his whole body, and he spends the rest of his life helping others to see what he has seen. That's where Buddhism starts. It starts with the Buddha, who was born Siddhartha Gautama. It starts with a man who lives an extraordinary life, the repercussions of which are being felt in Sheffield 2,500 years later. So what we're going to do over the next some time, probably about 4 months actually, if we're going to be clear about and spend the same amount of time on each of the refuges, or the jewels, we're going to spend the next 4 months looking at the Buddha, looking at the jewel of the Buddha. And this evening what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you an overview of the Buddha's life, just to sort of set us up. And then in the coming weeks we'll be looking at different episodes in the Buddha's life and seeing what we can draw out of them for our own practice. Okay, so the Buddha was born in Lumbini, in what is Nepal, currently Nepal. And he was born into a ruling family, a wealthy family. Sometimes it's said he was born in the he was the king's son. But actually it's probably more like it wasn't a king in the sense of a hereditary kingship. He was an elected ruler. But he was clearly born into a ruling family and a wealthy family. His mother died in childhood and he was brought up by his maternal aunt. And he says of himself, he says of his early life, that he was delicate, most delicate, supremely delicate. He says that lotus pools were made for his benefit. He had three lotus pools, one with just white lotuses, one with just red lotuses, and one with just blue lotuses. He bathed with Benares sandalwood, and he wore only the very best cloth. A white sunshade was held over him day and night, so that no cold, no heat, no dust, no grit, no dew could ever trouble him. And his parents found him a beautiful wife, who gave birth to a beautiful son. And he had three palaces. He had one palace for the winter, one palace for the summer, and one palace for the rains, for the rainy season. And every time the season changed, he'd go off to his different palace with a whole troop of female musicians to entertain him in his palaces. I don't know what his wife thought of that, but the scriptures don't tell us. So basically what the scriptures are telling us is that the Buddha had it all. He had status, he was the son of a wealthy local ruler, he had money, he had sensual pleasures, everything that he wanted he could have. He was the kind of pinnacle of worldly existence, and he was very, very handsome, it said. But still, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for the Buddha. He looked deeply into life. I suspect he was one of these people who, they don't just let things happen to them. They have to look deeply into what it means. And he looked deeply into life, and he was troubled. He was even disturbed by what he saw. And what did he see? Well, the first thing he saw was aging. And it's interesting, he says he saw how people turn away from the elderly. They turn away from the elderly, and they are shocked, humiliated, and disgusted by the elderly, by old people. Even though they themselves will get old one day. And it said that when he realized this, when he saw how people turn away from the elderly, shocked and disgusted and humiliated, the vanity of youth left him. And he saw that when people were sick, that people would turn away from them too, humiliated, shocked, and disgusted. And he saw, well, that's just, why are they doing that? Because they themselves will get sick one day. And it said that the vanity of health left him. And he saw that when people saw death, when they saw a dead body, and often in India, still to this day, we tend to take our dead people and put them in a box and don't look at them and then put them in a big oven. In the Buddha's day, as in India now, they carry them through the streets and you see their face. And he said that when he saw death coming through the streets, he saw how people turn away from death, shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, even though they themselves will one day die, and the vanity of life left him. And he saw how people quarrelled. He saw how people fought with one another. He saw people quarrelling, fighting, struggling. He said, like fish writhing in a pool fast drying up. So you get this image of beings like fish in a pool fast drying up, struggling, writhing around, desperate for water. And he was afraid. He saw this and he was afraid. And he longed to find shelter. He longed to find somewhere safe from aging, safe from sickness, safe from death, safe from fighting. But he says he couldn't find a shelter because the world is always changing and there is nothing that you can settle on. There is no shelter to be found in an ever-changing world. So he saw these things, and in a way, this is what we all see every day. It's not something that you can just kind of pass off into, oh, well, that's just ancient India. It's something that we can all see every day. We all see how when there's an old person and they're having difficulty, we very easily rush into impatience. And maybe it's because we can see that one day we're going to be like them. If we live to that age, we possibly will be like them. We'll be confused. Our body won't work. We'll get into younger people's way. There's a poem by Yeats where he says, I had forgiven enough who had forgiven old age. And maybe we see sometimes that that's something that we also have to forgive, because the temptation is very quickly to just turn away disgusted. And when people are sick, you know, the same thing can happen. We can feel, sort of impatient. You think, well, I just want to get on with my life. And it's just, you know, I've got all this plan about my week. And here's my friend who's sick. And being sick is not an attractive thing. When we're sick, we often smell. Our bodily functions go beyond our control. We're often incredibly boring to be around. And we turn away from that. We turn away from that because we see that, well, in a way, this could happen to me. And, you know, it's inconvenient. You've got your week planned, someone's ill, you've got to go and visit them. And it's inconvenient being ill. It's inconvenient smelling and being boring and being frightened because you don't know what the implications of your illness are. And we also see death. A friend of mine whose daughter died when her daughter was 19, and she said to me that when her daughter died, friends would cross over the road in the street to avoid her because they didn't know what to say. And I think we can all do that. We can all turn away from death. Even though we know it's going to happen to all of us, we can turn away from death because we don't know what to say. We don't know how to cope with it. You know, what do you say to someone whose 19-year-old daughter has just died of a drugs overdose? You know, what do you say? And in a way, these are all the things that the Buddha saw. He saw this and he saw how people quarrel and fight and how painful that is. How painful it is to watch people struggling and writhing and pushing against each other. And I suppose what happened to the Buddha is he saw all these things which are so painful to experience, and he didn't turn away. He didn't stop the questions that he started to ask. He looked deeply into existence and he thought, what does this mean? And it was this kind of questioning that initiated his spiritual quest. There's a later Buddhist teacher called Aryadeva who says, "The nature of existence, is it empty or not? Merely feeling this doubt tears conditioned existence apart." And that's what happened with the Buddha. He looked at these things. He looked at the suffering of men and women. He looked at aging and sickness and death. And he looked at quarrelling and fighting. And he asked himself why. And he asked himself, does this always have to happen? And it was that questioning that tore conditioned existence apart and initiated what he called his noble quest. And it's this kind of questioning that's vital to us also. Because without this kind of question, it's very easy to settle down. I put in my notes that I think everyone starts asking questions in childhood, but in the team meeting, that there was some doubt raised about that. I definitely started asking questions in childhood, you know, big, deep questions, not just like, when can I get my next dinner, or whatever it was. I started asking deep questions, and I think that other people do too. I remember, when you often find this actually, there's a certain beginner's night where we talk about why our kind of spiritual inclinations and our vision of existence and the kind of questions that we ask ourselves. And I remember being in this group, and all these men, I seemed to be in a group with a lot of men of around the same age, sort of in their middle age. And they were all saying, talking about the questions that they'd had as children. And they said, you know, I've never spoken to anyone about this, not anyone. And again, in my study group, we were recently talking about the same thing, about vision, our vision of existence. And people were saying about all these thoughts that they'd had in childhood. And the problem is that as we grow older, we push those questions down, we push those thoughts down, and we smother big questions with convenient answers. And we get on with the everyday business of living in order not to look too deeply. And I think that's what happens to human beings. It's like, you know, you can have these thoughts, you know, what does this mean? You see an old person in the street and you think, why? And but all too easy we just think, oh, well, you've got to get on, you know. Stop making a fuss, you just got to get on and get on with the business of living. You know, we've got a job to do, we've got dinner to eat, you know, I've only got my lunch break is over in 5 minutes and off we go. Sangharakshita, there's a wonderful talk that he did, which I really love, and part of that he says, we are dissatisfied, but we're not dissatisfied enough. So what we do is we tend to grumble. We grumble, we get disgruntled about, you know, the fact that we're all getting a bit older and, you know, everything starts to sag and your hair changes colour and you don't look as attractive as you did when you were younger. And we grumble about sickness and, you know, I was really planning to do all these things and I don't feel well. And actually that's what I do, I don't know about anyone, I don't feel well. And we get kind of, we get upset by death and we get upset by quarrelling, but we don't look deeply enough into why it happens. We don't look for the real answers to those big life questions, and we don't even see a possibility that maybe it doesn't have to happen like that. So what we try and do is we try and get rid of the superficial symptoms, but we don't question the whole structure of existence. Sangharakshita, sort of to try and make us understand this, he uses quite a good example, which is, you know, we grumble about being late for work because we get stuck in a traffic jam, but we don't look at the whole structure of why we need cars in the first place, you know, and why we need to go to work and why we need to rush around like this. We just grumble because our car, you know, we're late and we're stuck in a traffic jam, or the car's not working properly or something. And if we really start to question those things much, much deeper, you know, why do we have to work? Or why do people use cars? Or why do we have to be sort of slaves to the time? If we ask questions like that, like the Buddha did, people often just think we're mad and it's time to settle down. You know, those are the questions you ask when you've got a lot of time on your hands. But when you don't, you just need to get on with it. So we shouldn't, you know, those questions are the start of our spiritual quest, and we shouldn't answer our questions too early. And we shouldn't answer other people's questions too early, particularly children, particularly young people. There's a quote by Rilke where he says, you've got to learn to love the questions. And in a way, that's what we've got to do. We've also got to learn to love other people's questions, not to try and answer them or tidy them up. You know, even to say, yeah, that's a really good question. You know, why is it that people get old? Why is it that people get sick? Why do they quarrel? Why do they fight? And we've got to encourage each other to question more deeply and to find out our answers for ourselves in a long process of discovery. So this is what the Buddha did. He questioned life very, very deeply, and he entered what he called the Noble Quest. And he said that though he himself was subject to birth and aging, sickness, death and suffering, because he saw the dangers inherent in those things, he was going to seek a state beyond birth, beyond aging, beyond sickness, beyond death, beyond suffering. And the state that he was going to seek was the state of enlightenment. So that was his noble quest. Though he himself was subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and suffering, he was going to seek the state beyond birth, beyond aging, beyond sickness, beyond death, beyond suffering. And this is really amazing. This is what's really amazing about the Buddha. Because I've always wondered, how did he know that that state ever existed? How did he know that enlightenment was a possibility? Why did he even, I mean, what a kind of it's got cheek about it, that kind of quest, hasn't it? It's got profound cheek to think you could go and say, well, there must be a state beyond birth, and beyond aging, and beyond death, and sickness, and quarrelling, and suffering. And he knew no example of anyone who'd got enlightened. You know, it wasn't like he could just say, well, so-and-so's got enlightened, and I want to be like him. I want to be like the Buddha. You know, he had no path to follow that another Buddha had laid out for him. But he knew somewhere that it was possible. He knew it was possible to be liberated. And I never worked out how he knew that. So he decided to leave home. He decided to leave, search for the truth, search for enlightenment. And he said that he saw his home as crowded and dusty. Which reminds me, I don't know, have I got this right? Anyway, it reminds me of Miss Havisham's house. And is it Great Expectations? Okay. It reminds me of Miss Havisham's house and Great Expectations. So there she is, and she's surrounded by this wedding feast, which is slowly decaying, and she's still in this wedding dress, and all the shutters are closed, and it's just covered in dust. And that's what I think of when the Buddha says that. You know, he sees home as crowded and dusty. It's full of secrets, full of nothing ever moves. It's really stifling and oppressive. And there's all these kind of locked cupboards and things sort of decaying and covered in dust. And he longs to leave. He says it's not easy in those conditions to lead a spiritual life as utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. And he saw that life gone forth, as he put it, was wide open, and that was the life he was going to choose. So what does life gone forth actually mean? Well, in India at the time, there were two possibilities for the spiritual seeker. There was Brahmanism or Shramanism. And Brahmanism is the traditional Hindu orthodoxy based around the Brahmin caste. So the Brahmin caste is something that you're born into. It's like a tribe or a family that you're born into. And they were the only ones who were allowed to hold any religious knowledge. Everyone else who wasn't born into the Brahmin caste had to rely on the Brahmins for their interpretation of spiritual matters, which included paying them to get the interpretation of the spiritual matters, and just get on with their own caste duty. So, you know, if you were born in the ruling caste, you would rule. If you were born in the merchant caste, you would be a merchant. You just get on with your own kind of, your own hereditary duty. And the Buddha was not born a Brahmin. So he couldn't seek the truth, the spiritual matters, in Brahmanism. So he decided to seek the truth in with the Shramanas. So the Shramanas are those who have gone forth. They're the homeless wanderers who, even today actually, but certainly in the Buddha's day, they wandered around India. They didn't hold necessarily to a caste system. They wandered around India looking for an answer to human suffering using physical and mental training. So, you know, there were loads of, there still is, loads of different sort of paths that the Shramanas follow. There's things like the Buddha's day talks about someone who whose spiritual path was living like a dog, so just pretending that he was a dog. There was, I think this still goes on today actually, there's the spiritual practice where you sit at noon, so in the plains of India where it's really hot, you sit under the midday sun, surrounded by four fires in each direction. So that was your physical and mental training. And the Buddha decided that, you know, they're kind of very wild people, actually, the Shramanas. He decided, well, that's where I'm going to find the truth, so I'm going to go and join the Shramanas. He didn't choose to live like a dog, I have to say. He decided to find some teachers who could teach him meditation techniques. So off he went. He went to, I'll just tell you. So he says of himself, he says, while still young, a black-haired boy blessed with youth, in the first phase of life, I shaved off my hair and beard, though my mother and father grieved with tearful faces, and I put on the yellow robe and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So this story gets elaborated a great deal in the later Buddhist texts. But here it's quite simple. He says he was a black-haired boy blessed with youth, but even though his parents begged him not to go, he shaved off his hair and beard, put on the robes of a beggar, and went forth in the home life, from the home life into homelessness. He decided to become a shramana, a wandering mendicant, a beggar, a bum. So the Buddha wandered away from his home city. He left his palaces, his family, even his wife and child, and took up with three different teachers who taught him meditation techniques. And in each case, what happened is he perfected their own teaching. And he became so kind of developed in the teaching of each teacher that the teacher said, well, you know, you've reached my level, so you should lead this community of disciples with me. So he was offered the chance to lead a community of disciples, and he perfected each meditation technique he was taught. But it wasn't enough. It wasn't the end of suffering. It wasn't the end of birth and aging and sickness and death. It wasn't enlightenment. And so he wandered on. And this is very significant because if we imagine what it must have been like for the Buddha, you know, he'd been with these teachers and he perfected their meditation. So basically what that meant is he was in meditative states that none of us probably have ever been in. I mean, they're incredibly pleasurable. You could just be in those states the rest of your existence and be completely happy. They're blissful. They're absolutely wonderful. And he could have had all the status that he wanted. He could have lived a really happy life in blissful states of meditation, being quite ethical. He would have been living, you know, in a very, very simple way, very ethical way, in this beautiful mental state. And he would have actually had quite a positive effect on the people in the community around him. But it wasn't enough. How did he know it wasn't enough? You know, if I was there, I would just think, yeah, well, you know, I've made it. Who cares if I die? Fantastic, you know. I'm in the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. It's fantastic. I don't even think at all. So, yeah, that would be great. I'd be happy with that. But no. No, the Buddha had to leave. He had to decide to go forth again. Go forth from status, go forth from even spiritual pleasure. And he took up extreme mental and physical ascetic practices. So the first thing he did, there's this fantastic scene where it goes through all of this at great length. It's really gory. Anyway, I'll summarise it for you. What he did is he tried to just beat down his mind with mind. He was going to constrain and crush his mind with the power of his own mind. And apparently all that happened is he got a really bad headache. So he decided to stop that. He decided to stop breathing by the force of his will. He decided to even stop breathing through his ears. I didn't even know I breathed through my ears, but anyway, apparently he did. So he tried to stop breathing. And that didn't work. He just said he just got filled with all these really horrible internal winds. It gets worse. So after that, he decided to stop eating. And he said his backside became like a camel's hoof. And his ribs jutted out as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. And his eyes sank into his sockets like deep wells. And his scalp shriveled and withered like an old gourd. And his spine could be felt by poking from his belly. And when he went to the toilet, he fell over in his own excrement. And when he touched his skin, all his hair fell out because it was rotted at the roots. Gory. That's just half of it. Anyway. So he became very well renowned as the foremost in asceticism. You know, he could punish himself like no one could punish himself. And still he realized that it wasn't enough. He realized that actually you can't progress spiritually by an act of will. And maybe you've even discovered this in your own mindfulness of breathing. You know, if you just try and sort of force your busy mind, like, right, concentrate on the breath. 1, 2, 3. What you end up with is a very bad thing. And you can't do it by the force of your will alone. If you try and do it by the force of your will alone, you'll just rebel. Oh dear, I've actually damaged Kate. So what he realised is that pleasure is not bad in itself. And it's interesting because he said, well, there was no need to be frightened of pleasure. He said, well, there's pleasure associated with unskillful behaviour, with greed, hatred and delusion. But there's also pleasure associated with the joy of the spiritual life. And that pleasure is necessary in the spiritual life. Without finding pleasure in the spiritual life, you're not going to do it. And he remembered in childhood sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. And he remembered just being in this cool shade of the rose apple tree and being completely happy. And because he was completely happy and content, he just naturally went into higher states of concentration, higher states of meditation, just naturally, without forcing himself or starving himself or stopping breathing. He just was happy, and because he was happy, he was concentrated. And he thought, well, why not try that again? So again he went forth, the third going forth. He went forth from trying to force his will to make him spiritually progress. He went forth from that. He accepted a little food, and all his disciples left him in disgust, because some disciples had gathered around him because he was so good at asceticism. But then he ate something, and they thought, oh, wow, he's lost it now. So they all went off in a huff, and he found a cool grove near a clear flowing river, and he sat underneath the tree on a smooth bank. And he meditated. Some say he was doing the mindfulness of breathing. And what happened was his mind became malleable. It became pure and bright and concentrated. And then the eye of the Buddha opened. And it was like a great sun illuminating the dark sky. And he sat for a long time, sometimes it says 7 weeks, with the whole of existence unravelling before him. And there was a tremendous amount of energy within there. He'd spent so long searching for the truth. And all that energy just poured into this experience. And enlightenment was revealed to him in all directions over 7 weeks. One aspect after the other aspect after the other aspect. And first of all, he saw his whole existence spread out before him. He saw lives upon lives upon lives. Here in this life, I had this name and this family. This is what I did. This is where I lived. And then I became this person of this family, and this is where I lived, and this is what I did. Each rebirth, tumbling into the next, he just saw the whole lot in one great direct flush. And he saw the existences not only of himself, but of all beings. He saw how each person's action comes into fruition, how habits accumulate into personalities, how personalities influence people's lives, and how lives influence death. And he saw the whole wheel of life revolving aeon after aeon after aeon, the whole thing. He could see each part of it, and he could see each consequence of each action. He saw universes coming in and out of existence, the whole flux of existence. And more than all of this, he saw that he was free. He was free from craving, from fleeting and worldly pleasures, and he was free from desire to create existence, to always build the self. This is me, this is mine, this is me, this is mine. He was free of all of that. And he was free of every single opinion and the thicket of views. And he was free from ignorance. And he saw, what was to be done is done. There is no more of this to come. He had transcended birth and aging and sickness and death and all suffering. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build this house again. Your rafters have been broken. Your ridgepole is demolished too. But it still wasn't enough. Even though the Buddha was enlightened, the next part of his enlightenment experience unraveled before him, and he looked around and he saw all beings like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence. And he saw that while some were immersed in the mud of existence, some had started to grow and some were near the surface of the lake. And he trembled. He trembled with all beings out of great compassion. All beings have the potential to grow. Each and every single person has the potential to grow. And there are some who will be able to understand his truth. Some have little dust in their eyes and they are lost through not hearing the Dharma. So he decided that he had to get up. He had to leave the beautiful bank by the beautiful river under the beautiful tree and beat the drum of the deathless, set in motion the wheel of the Dharma. And that's what he did. He spent the rest of his life, around 50 years, teaching those who could be taught. And he taught them by many different ways. He taught them with arguments, with philosophical discussion. He taught them with parables and similes. He taught them with discourses. He taught them with poetry and inspired utterances. He taught by his own examples. And he sometimes even taught by silence. Sometimes he even taught just by his physical presence. Apparently he had very, very beautiful presence. And some people saw something through that. Sometimes he even had conversation through telepathy. And sometimes he taught people through supernatural acts. And he was a teacher. He was a teacher to many. But he was also a friend to many, an exemplar. And what happened was his community grew and grew and grew, and even grows to this day. We're even in his community, even now, 2,500 years later, in Sheffield, that community carries on. So there it is, the potted life history of the Buddha. And, you know, you can read all this. I really, really recommend the best book of the sort of ancient sources of the Buddha's life. The best book to read, if you want to look at that, is The Life of the Buddha by Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. And it just goes through with all the original sources. And it's a wonderful read. I mean, it's completely incredible. Then, you know, you can read all about his life in that book and in other books. But don't think that because you've heard the story, you know who the Buddha is. Because, after all, we don't even know each other that well. Sometimes we don't even know the people we live with that well. We don't even know our parents that well, or our friends, or our lovers, or whoever it is. We don't even know our children very well. So if we don't know all of these people very well, we're hardly likely to be able to know the Buddha who lived in ancient India very well either, if we're just reading books. So sometimes you think you can, you know, you get the book, you read the story, you think, okay, I know about the life of the Buddha. You know, what's there to know? He was a prince, left home, got enlightened, as you do. But actually, we don't know the Buddha at all. The Buddha is a bit of a mystery. And there's an interesting story that demonstrates this. The Buddha was travelling, and a Brahmin called Dona saw his footprints in the road. Now, the Buddha's footprints weren't ordinary footprints. The Buddha's footprints had a perfect wheel in them. So the Buddha was travelling up ahead in the road, and Dona saw these footprints, and he thought, whose footprints are those? That's not the footprints of a human being. So he followed the footprints. And eventually he came to the Buddha, and the Buddha was sitting under a tree by the side of the road, and he was an incredible presence. He sort of shone with this light. And he was very, very mindful. It said that he was like a great elephant, a great tamed elephant. There was all this tremendous amount of power and energy, but all completely focused, very controlled, very one-pointed, very, very beautiful. And Dona was just absolutely amazed. He was so impressed. And he said, so he came up to the Buddha, which is actually kind of think about it, it was a bit rude because the Buddha was meditating, but anyway, Dona didn't notice that because he was just thinking, this is amazing, what is this being? You know. So he came up and he said, excuse me, are you a god? And the Buddha said, no, I'm not a god. He said, then are you a heavenly angel? And the Buddha said, no, I'm not a heavenly angel. He said, okay, so are you a spirit, a yaksha? And the Buddha said, no, I'm not a spirit. He said, well, okay, so are you a human being? And the Buddha said, no, I'm not a human being. And so you could see, Dona was like, so what are you then? It was like all his categories had run out at this point. And the Buddhist answered, he said, well, the means of which I might have been a god, or an angel, or a spirit, or a human being, are cut off at the root. He said, it's like I'm a lotus that has left behind the water. I have left behind this world. There is nothing by which you can measure me. And another time he says, when a person has gone out, then there is nothing by which you can measure him. That by which he can be talked about is no longer there for him. When all ways of being are removed, then all ways of description are removed. So you might think, well, you know, it's a little kind of quaint story about ancient India. But actually, Dona's dilemma is ours, because we have no idea where to place the Buddha, in what category. And what we do is we try to, sometimes we make the Buddha a god. So we see the Buddha, you know, there he is, far, far away. Someone totally special and unique. He's some sort of distant wonder on the horizon. You know, and he's extraordinary. He's lived this really special and amazing life. But it's kind of nothing to do with me, you know. He's quite special and I'm not. And, you know, well, like, I suppose you could do that kind of thing in ancient India, but you can't do it now in Sheffield, you know, because I've got work to do, and, you know, you can't go around begging from door to door. And, you know, the Buddha was a really special guy. He was, you know, he's like a god. You can't be the Buddha. You know, and then what happens is we might pray to the Buddha, but you never think of yourself as being able to become a Buddha. In the end, what happens is the Buddha becomes a sort of ornament, a sort of lucky token, if you like, in our lives. And yes, it's a beautiful ornament. It's a very lovely, lucky amulet in your life. But, you know, it's quite distant. The Buddha's kind of kept up there on the shelf with sort of interesting, exotic Eastern things. you know, some sort of Eastern god, and, you know, if you rub his belly sometimes, I hear he'll grant you a wish. So you make an offering to the Buddha, and then you go home and do exactly what you were doing anyway. And sometimes we try and compensate from this seeing Buddha as a god by bringing Buddha down to our level. So we say, well, you know, the Buddha was just a human. He was just a human being. You know, he's a very good human being, a very wise human being, a very ethical human being. In a way, he becomes the sort of supreme humanitarian. And all the supernormal stories, all the verses of praise, all the golden light and the, you know, sitting there like an elephant or whatever it is, well, they're actually just later additions made up by overzealous sort of disciples who wanted him to be a god. But actually, he wasn't a god. He was just a human being who had it kind of sorted. Actually, we don't know. The Buddha himself said he was neither of those things. He wasn't a human being, actually. And he wasn't a god either. And what happens is we project onto the Buddha what we want him to be. We project what we want him for ourselves. So, you know, it's interesting to see what you think about the Buddha. And we all do it, but, you know, if we're feeling a bit trapped, then when we talk about the Buddha and think about the Buddha represents freedom. And if we're consumed with negative emotion and we think about the Buddha, we think about the Buddha's love. And if we're crowded and busy and have a frantic life, when we think about the Buddha, we think of some sort of silent, peaceful, calm sage. So that's one way we project what we want for ourselves onto the Buddha. But we sometimes also project onto the Buddha what we like so that we don't have to change. So if we don't want to study, then, well, you know, the Buddha couldn't read or write. You know, he was just about love. And if we don't want to develop our emotions, we say, well, you know, the Buddha, he saw into reality, and we've got to see into reality. And if we find myth and legend incomprehensible and it just turns us off, when we say, well, you know, the Buddha was a very, very rational man, a very rational man. And if we don't want to put his teaching into practice, when we say, well, you know, he's a kind of god, you know, and you know, well, I could never do that. So how do we ever get to know the Buddha? Because we're constantly doing this. We're constantly projecting ourselves onto the Buddha. Well, a clue to how to get to know the Buddha is given in the story of Vakali. So Vakali was a elderly disciple of the Buddha, and he was dying. And he asked for the Buddha to come and see him. And the Buddha came to see him. And first of all, what happened was Vakali tried to get up, you know. And the Buddha said, no, don't get up. There's a seat here. I'll sit on this seat. So the Buddha sat by the bed and he asked him a few questions about his health. And then he said, you know, because Vakali was going to die soon, he said, well, you know, I hope that you don't have any remorse. And Vakali said, well, actually, I do have a lot of remorse. In fact, I'm consumed with remorse and regret. And the Buddha said, well, I'm very sorry to hear that. Have you done something unethical? And Vakali said, no, I haven't done anything unskillful. I haven't done anything unethical. And the Buddha said, well, then why are you filled with remorse? And Vakali said, well, I wanted to see you. I wanted to see the Buddha before I died. But I was too ill to come and see you. And the Buddha said, enough, Vakali. Why do you need to see this body? He who sees the Dharma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dharma. So to see the Buddha, what we have to see is the Dharma itself. And you might remember Dharma has lots of meanings, but the main two are the Buddha's teaching and the truth itself. So first of all, we have to see the Dharma in the sense of the Buddha's teaching. We have to put into practice the teaching of the Buddha. And yes, the Buddha is an exceptional man, was an exceptional man. He spent many lifetimes perfecting himself. But we can emulate the Buddha. We can look deeply into the world and ask questions. Every time we see an old person, every time we see a sick person, every time we encounter death or fighting or suffering, we can ask the same questions as the Buddha. We can also go forth from meaningless sensory pleasures. We can go forth from status. We can go forth from old ways of doing things. We can also find pleasure in our spiritual practice. We also can go on a noble quest. And we can also never give up until we have transcended birth, transcended aging, transcended sickness, transcended death, and transcended suffering altogether. And we can also share our path to freedom with others. We can also share our inspiration with others. And in that way, practicing the Dharma wholeheartedly for the rest of our lives, we'll be able to see the Buddha. And there's also the Dharma in the sense of the truth itself, in the sense of seeing the way things are. Because if we really practice the Dharma, then we'll be able to see the way things are, and the Dharma in its fullest sense. So there's a lovely thing in later Buddhism, actually. They talk about the highest state of the spiritual aspirant is devotion. And that is the highest state, because when you've practiced the teachings, when you've really developed wisdom and love, you start to approach the mind of the Buddhas themselves. And when you approach the mind of the Buddhas themselves, you really see the significance of the Buddha. You really see the true splendor of the Buddha. You become one with the heart and mind of the Buddhas, and you see how absolutely wonderful it is. And you've got no option left but just to rejoice and praise the Buddhas. And that's why it's the highest state of the spiritual aspirant, because the closer you get to wisdom, the closer you are to the mind of the Buddha, and the more you rejoice and give devotion to the Buddha, the more you see the splendor of the Buddha. So when I was talking about, talking to Padma Vajra about this talk, and I said, I have to do a whole overview of the life of the Buddha, and I'm really frightened it's going to be a bit boring, actually. And Padma Vajra said to me, he said, well, don't worry about it. What you need to do is communicate your love of the Buddha. So I started to think, why do I love the Buddha? Why do I love the Buddha? You know, and I thought, I really do, actually. You know, and I spend a lot of time going over the old stories. And when I look at the old stories of the Buddha, my eyes fill with tears. And I feel really, really inspired. And I don't know why it is, but all I know is the more I practice, the closer I get to the Buddha. And the more love and gratitude I feel to the Buddha. And that wasn't always the case. You know, when I first started practicing the Buddha, it was a bit of a mystery to me. And I wasn't actually that interested in a certain sense. But the more I practice, the more love and gratitude I feel to the Buddha. And the more I delve into the profound mystery of the Dharma, the closer I get to the profound mystery of the Buddha himself. And I get to this thing where I can really see him. You know, I can really see him. There's something in those stories. I can feel them. There's a feeling, and I sort of feel like I know what it's about. And this gives great sustenance to my practice, great inspiration to me over the years. Because practicing the Dharma is hard. It's hard. And you need to find inspiration and sustenance where you can. And where I find it is looking at the old stories of the Buddha. So it's worth remembering the advice of the long-haired sage called Dark Splendor. Fantastic. Yeah, that's why I like looking at the old stories of the Buddha, because you get to have stories about long-haired sages called Dark Splendor. So Dark Splendor was someone who, when he saw the Buddha as a child, and there's some beautiful verses of praise to the Buddha as a child, and he saw the Buddha as a child and predicted his enlightenment. But he knew that he was going to die before the Buddha reached enlightenment, before the child Siddhartha Gautama reached enlightenment. So he instructed his nephew before he left, and he said, "One day you will hear someone talking about a Buddha. You will hear of a man who has reached full enlightenment by following the correct path. When you hear this, go and find out all the details of his teaching. Go and live with this master, this Lord, and follow the practices of a pure life."